Said if you behave, he'll give you 45 minutes next year. Our next guest is a familiar face, I should say, to the HMA, well, sort of. For years, organizations across the country, including many HMA member companies, have relied on the forecasting of ITR economics to position themselves for future growth. Joining us today is economist, business analyst, and ITR CEO, Brian Ballew. Yes, he looks just like his brother, Alan. I hope that's a good thing. His presentation entitled Ahead of the Curve 2014-2017 will include business cycle forecasts as well as strategic action items to help us all increase our competitive advantage. Join me, please, in welcoming Brian Ballew.
Thank you very much. And thank you, Brian.
Thank you very much.
There's nothing there. Let's see. We need to get rid of that. We need to pull up this one. Here we go. And they said it couldn't be done. And it was. Good morning. Thank you for letting me substitute for my brother, Alan, whom most of you already know. He sends his regards and a reminder that he is the smarter, better-looking brother, whatever that works for him. Please notice the title of the talk, Ahead of the Curve. The reason we have that title for this year is because we don't have any major concerns for anybody in this room through 2017. We see the housing industry and the industrial markets generally growing for 14, 15, 16, and 17. In 2018, we may see some difficulty in the housing market, and in 2019, we may see some difficulty in the industrial market. But at least for the next 4 years inclusive, you should be expecting nice upside activity. My major challenge to you this morning is to ask yourselves, are you ready to be that much busier? Do you have enough people, the right people, trained people? Do you have the sufficient working capital? Do you have enough resources? Do you have enough capacity? Because if you're feeling really busy now and if you're feeling really stressed right now because you are so busy, then the next 4 years aren't going to be as much fun as they should be. You should be smiling just about every day you go into work for the next 4 years, maybe 5 years. Because these are the good times. And enjoy them. Thank you very much. Appreciate you listening. Really, what more do you want us to say? Is there anybody here who has not seen an ITR presentation before, either Alan or one of our other speakers? Or are you all familiar with this? Okay, let me just go through this then, even though you heard a very nice introduction. This is how 2013 worked out relative to our forecast. This is something that every economist should be willing to show you. And if they don't show this to you, you should wonder why. The first column is our major headline item, U.S. GDP, U.S. industrial production, Europe, Canada, China, U.S. housing, retail sales, and employment. The second column is very important, duration. How long was that forecast in place before the end of the year, before December 2013. So our housing forecast, for instance, was in place and we did not change it for a year. It covered the entire span of 2013. Then we have the actual forecast, the actual result, and then the percent deviation. And the worst thing on this list, unfortunately for us, this morning was housing, which came in 2.3% below our expectations. But that was an expectation set 1 year in advance. We were on the low side of most people's forecasts for 2013. Yet, housing didn't even come up to our expected levels. The reason I'm pointing that out to you is, Judd, you had a chart up there from Census Bureau, and I'm not sure what the other organization was, that had housing just soaring for the next several years. And if you paid close attention to that, I want you to sort of file that under your mental listing of best case scenario. Because we don't think housing is going to grow faster in 2014 than it did in 2013, yet that's what that chart implied. In fact, we think there's going to be a very real slowdown in the rate of rise in housing, but it is still going to rise in 2014. We think housing starts in the U.S. 14 will be up 3.4% over the prior year. That's low compared to most of our competitors. For 2015, we're looking at a 7.1% year-over-year increase. And then for 2016, we're looking for a 12.8% rise. In 2017, we're looking at a 5.8% rise, which gets us into very nice volume levels, but not nearly as fast as our competitors think. We are assuming low interest rates. That's not the issue. We're just assuming that there's going to be some tax increases coming along. We're going to see that disposable personal income, because of those tax increases, is not able to rise quite fast enough to continue this robust ascent in housing. We're going to see that pricing becomes more of an issue within the housing market. Affordability becomes more of an issue. And we'll talk about all of that in a little bit later. Right now, 2013 came in on target with our expectations, and we aren't expecting any major surprises for 14, despite some of the things currently going on. There has been a change in our 2014 outlook, though, and you can see that on this chart. This is U.S. industrial production's 12-month moving average. And the green line is actual results, and the different colored triangles are different forecasts that we've had in place. I tend to change that forecast whenever we go through an inflection point. And we see that the green line on the right here has been running right underneath our gold triangles. There hasn't been any major surprises. Before we've even gotten there, though, I've taken away that mild decline that you see in 2014 that Alan had been talking about, I had been talking about, based on updated leading indicator activity, based on the trends that we see at the end of 2013, despite the polar vortex. What we've done is we've taken away that even mild downturn in the 12-month moving average and made it more of a flat spot, mild period of rise. So we've really upgraded our forecast for 2014, and we expect nice rise in 15, 16, 17, and for U.S. industrial production, and therefore the industrial markets, probably rise in 2018 as well. So good things coming up. In 2018, we expect housing is going to have a bit of a decline, and I'll define that for you in just a little bit. In 2019, we think there's going to be a macroeconomic recession going on, which means the industrial side will have some softness. The next real recession we see in the economy, therefore, that will impact both sides of your house, industrial and the high grade, will be in late 2018 and on into 2019. At ITR, we are all about management objectives. What do you do with this information? Well, before I even get to explaining why we think that downturn is going to be there, this is what you do with this information so far in this presentation. One, you make sure that you're very aggressive in your plans for the next 4 to 5 years, that you have enough people, you have enough resources, you've lined up enough capacity, enough raw material. Two, you think about maybe selling the business in 2017, 2018. If you own your own business, sell it to your kids. Let them take it down into the next recession. You can buy it back for them in 2020 at a significantly discounted price, and you'll have taught them all about economics in a couple of short years. They'll have degrees in it by then. That's what it's going to take, though, to stay ahead of this changing economy of ours. We think that there's this many years of growth ahead of us, despite the problems we have with the national debt and fiscal issues in different states, because there are some very important subtext trends going on. Judd, you mentioned one of them that is very, very important, and that's our increasing energy independence. That can't be understated in terms of how important that is to our economic well-being going forward. And that is spawning other trends that we will be talking about. Before we come back to the United States, I like to put the U.S. into a global construct for people. This is an update from what Alan showed you last year. You're looking at global GDP, that's this whole pie. In the United States, we're 21.9% of the world's economy. Last year, we were 21.7. So the world's number one economy got even larger in the last year. Number two, according to their own statistics, is 11.5%, China. I went online this morning, the chief economist for China, his name is Wei Lai. All right? Take those numbers with a big grain of salt, folks. Number three is Japan, and they're shrinking. Number four is Germany, then France, and then the United Kingdom. Big change from the prior years, Brazil and Russia, they've both surpassed Italy as of the latest data. Like, that was really hard to do, to surpass Italy. Then you have India, which has now surpassed Canada, and then the others haven't really changed, Australia, Spain, Mexico, and Korea. As you contemplate the future, there are three megatrends that you must keep in mind. And they're all going to be beneficial or harmful to this industry, depending on how you prepare for it. One is demographics. There is going to be 1 billion more people on planet Earth between now and 2050. 1 billion more people. Here in the United States alone, there's going to be about 100, 120 million more people. What are they all going to want? Homes. Stuff. And what's it take to get that stuff to them? Well, right now it takes rail. This is an incredibly important dynamic for the U.S. economy, as opposed to China, where they're losing people. Their population is shrinking. Japan population is shrinking. Germany's is shrinking. France is shrinking. United Kingdom, the Brits stopped doing it a long time ago, folks. There's a shrinking also. Brazil's is growing. Russia, shrinking. You know how many Russians there are today? 142. There's 142 million Russians, 316 million Americans. You know what that means? We could take them. That's a get Putin up here. We want to talk to you. Enough of this nonsense. Don't you know how to do math? Italy is declining. India has a growing population. I'm excited about India too, but I've been a Chicago Cubs baseball fan, so I'm not sure I really know how to pick the winners. Canada. Any Canadians here, by the way? I always need to ask that question. Canadians? One, I'm glad they invited you. You're from the Greater Toronto Area, I presume, or are you from the West Coast? East Coast, Maritimes? Which province, sir? New Brunswick. I won't go there because you're all by yourself. But being from New Brunswick, you're used to being all by yourself, so that's okay. Australia, positive demographic. Spain, negative. Mexico, positive. Korea, negative. The second mega trend to keep in mind is inflation. There is going to be more inflation. You folks are seeing it in the hardwood lumber prices, which are up double digits year over year, whereas most Americans aren't seeing that yet. It's going to be happening to more and more Americans as the years go by. History is exceedingly clear on this point. Countries that have a deep and broad natural resource base will fare well during periods of inflation compared to those that don't. And that deep natural resource base is found in the United States. It is not present in China. It is not present in Japan, Germany, France. When was the last time France exported anything besides hubris? Really, they ran out a long time ago. Brazil, very nice natural resource base. Russia, but an ability to screw that up. India, decent. Canada, exceedingly good. Australia, very good. And Mexico, very good. The third megatrend to consider is government and how government is going to interfere or get out of the way of the economy, one way or the other. And there, the United States, at least in the near term, doesn't score all that well. We seem more and more inclined to interfere with the economy rather than get out of the way of the economy. Mexico is probably on the other end of that spectrum because they're allowing more and more U.S. technology into Pemex, which is really going to make a difference to their ability to get at those natural resources. There's two points I'm trying to make off of this, and they're at really extremes of this chart. One, as far as an exciting, fast-growing, relatively local market, you're going to be hard-pressed to beat Mexico. Growing population, smaller families, higher level of education, expanding middle class, more and more manufacturing going on down there. You've got to be looking at Mexico more and more as a market, as an opportunity, as a place to be doing business. Now, when I say that, most people look at me like I'm crazy because they read the newspapers and they know about everything going on in Mexico in terms of, or at least seemingly going on with the drugs and the violence and the murders and et cetera. To which I say, oh, goodness gracious, isn't that why we created vice presidents? So we could send them to markets like Mexico? We don't have to go. Don't you have B-team salespeople you can send to Mexico so that you don't have to go? Use your head. This is basic HR stuff. Alan may have mentioned in years past, and this is the second point I want to get at. Alan may have mentioned in years past that we're doing an awful lot of research into the future of the United States, in particular the 2030, 2040 decade. But tangential to that was, what happens to the United States after 2030, 2040? I mean, what's the long-term view for the United States? We've finished writing our book. It'll be out in July of this year. And the conclusions are very heartening. The U.S. is the number one economy on the planet today. It'll be the number one economy by far on the planet in 25 years. It'll be the number one economy on the planet by far over the next 50 years. When we look at demographics, natural resources, culture, and government, I'll throw it in, nobody's going to come close to beating the United States for the next 50 years. What that means to you in very practical terms is this: stop worrying so much about your kids or your grandkids. They are going to have a better economy than you have had. We are making the decisions, the trends are in place today that will give them a better life. And what you do to translate that thought into action is very simple. Tell them to get a job and get out of the house. It's time. What they really need is experience. No more hugs, experience. That's what the future requires of them, if we're going to remain number one anyways. As we look around the world, leading indicators aren't saying recession. They aren't saying accelerating growth, though, either. Most of the leading indicators are showing slowdown is the most probable outcome for 2014. We expect fairly aggressive monetary policy across the world. Some notable exceptions would be Turkey, Brazil, and Australia. But most places, including the United States, are going to keep interest rates at rock bottom levels, keep the money supply growing. And that'll help keep the economy growing. Employment is rising. It's rising fast enough, more importantly. Let me make employment very easy for you. If you read or hear that employment in the United States is up 150,000 jobs in any given month, 150K. That's good. That's a good number. Anything above that is gravy. Anything below 150,000 means that we have a problem or a developing problem. And you must watch that number very carefully. Because less than 150,000, we're not creating enough jobs to take into consideration or to absorb our expanding demographic. So for more people to really be employed and our economy to really grow, we need 150. Last month was a very good month. December and January weren't so good. But we had some very weird weather also in December and January, so it's hard to tell. But that's how you read the employment data. Unemployment's down to about 7% in the United States. It's not good by U.S. standards, but it's a heck of an improvement from where we were before. Our long-range forecast for unemployment rate in the United States is that by the end of 2016, we'll probably be at around 5.9% unemployment rate. At 5.9% in the United States, we will be at virtually full employment, even though it's still high by U.S. standards. The management objective, the applicability of that statement is simply this: you cannot afford to have anything less than excellent training programs for the people you need to onboard at all levels of your business. People aren't going to come to you with any more experience than they have been in the past. They're not going to come to you any smarter than they have in the past. And the labor pool is getting more and more shallow. You must invest in training programs, and you must constantly invest in increasing the skill levels of your employees. That'll be critical to maximizing your upside potential over the next 5 years. Retail sales are rising here and abroad, including in China. Retail sales, as long as you hear retail sales in the U.S. are up 2.5% or better, then you know the economy is growing and you can relax. That's on a deflated year-over-year basis. 2.5% is what you want to catch. Right now, we're at 3.9% growth rate in retail sales on an annual basis, despite a poor January or seemingly poor January, so we don't have anything to worry about there. Housing is clearly on the rise. I already gave you those numbers. And non-residential construction is also improving. Non-res is on the opposite end of the spectrum from housing. Housing is a leading economic indicator. Non-res is a lagging economic indicator. And non-res is likely to rise well into 2019 before it experiences its next broad-based slowdown. It's pedal to the metal time for all of us. There are some buts, of course, because this is economics. One of those buts is the stock market. I don't know what Alan told you a year ago, but one of the things that I got wrong a year ago, I showed you what we got right. One of the things that I got wrong a year ago was the stock market. I thought the stock market wouldn't make it out of 2013 without a major correction having begun. Obviously, that was not the case. 2013 ended with a roar. January was down, but February came back with another roar. This market has been defying my loose expectations. I continue to worry about this market, though, and I'll develop that with you a little bit more later on. I'm concerned because of the Affordable Care Act, aka Obamacare. Our analysis is this: there's nothing affordable about the Affordable Care Act. For employers in particular, but also for many, many employees. And this is going to hurt their ability to spend money the more and more the ACA gets implemented. And exactly how that's going to play out in the economy, we don't know, but it can't be good. Taxes are going up. Whether you're a Republican or a Democrat, I don't care. You must understand taxes are going up. Representative Camp's tax proposals, even though they were touted as being revenue neutral, if you earned more than $450,000 a year, your taxes most assuredly were going to be going up. They're closing loopholes, which means some of us win, some of us lose. The thing with that is, and I'm not trying to be controversial with this, it's just reality. When the government takes a dollar out of our pockets and spends it, it isn't spending the same dollar. Studies show that when a government is as indebted to the world as our federal government is, they take a dollar out of our pocket, they spend it, but that dollar only, in reality, is 70 cents by the time it goes through the economy. 30 cents of it is wasted, gone, never to be seen from again. Rising taxes, therefore, tends to be a real drag on our economy. And at ITR, we don't have any confidence that we're going to figure out a solution to our fiscal issues anytime in the near term. There seems to be zero political will to get that done in Washington, and that remains a threat hanging over our heads. You've mentioned you've seen this, or you've seen ITR before, so I'm just going to very quickly remind you how we run rate of change in case you don't use it but once a year during an ITR presentation. We start with monthly data. These dates are hypothetical because they go through 2014. We'll take that monthly data and we'll calculate three-month moving totals. And then we'll compare one three-month moving total as, say, the last one, 3MMT for December, compared to 1 year ago. And when you take 5.3 and you divide it by 4.8, you come up with 10.5. That's a 3-12 rate of change. Then we'll cast that aside and we'll look at a 12-12 rate of change, which is 12 months worth of data added up. So we'll take that 20.3 divided by the year ago, 12-month moving total of 18.0, and we come up with 12.7. Here's how you read rate of change charts very, very clearly, succinctly. When the rates of change are above zero, that's one positive sign. When the 312 or the 112 is running below this 12 over 12 rate of change, however, that's a flashing yellow light, warning light. Things are shifting. We're slowing down. We got to be careful how much they're going to slow down. When that 312 is running above 1212, and you are going to see that on some of our charts, that's a clear, solid green light. It means go, go, go. That's what you do with rate of change. Right now, for USIP, which is the blue line, and GDP, which is the brown line, we are in a very positive cyclical position. You're looking at a 3 over 12 rate of change, so it's quarterly data compared to year-ago quarterly data. This is from 1982 forward. And you can see those 312s are generally moving upward. Below the zero line represents recessions, early 1980s, early 1990s, 2000, 2001, 2008, 2009, the great recession in through here. I've already alluded to the fact that we think that there's going to be another recession in 2019. I'm using this chart to put that into some context for you. We think 2019 will come in rank-wise between the early 1990s and the early 1980s in severity. It won't be anything like what we had to go through here in 2008-2009. The economic imbalances that led to that downturn are not going to be present again that quickly. So it'll be a much more manageable recession that we see out there in 18 or 19, depending on how you are looking at it. The other thing I want you to get off this chart is notice, and just use your mind's eye, where we are today, both in the blue line, which is IP, and GDP. We're about average rate of growth for our economy. Our industry, at least in terms of housing, started off in a painstakingly slow recovery, but it's gained speed. Don't buy into the premise that the overall economy has been engaged in an extremely lackluster recovery. That's not true. The rate of recovery is normal. IP is at record highs, GDP is at record highs, retail sales at record highs, consumer is in great shape. People want you to think that our economy needs some external help to continue to rise. What it really needs is to be left alone, and it'll rise just fine. We look at leading indicators all the time at ITR. This is our favorite. It's the ITR leading indicator. Our leading indicator is the brown line here, and if the technology works, I'm going to be able to... No, I didn't want to shift that. I want to shift the brown line. There we go. That brown line leads the overall economy, USIP, by about 11 months, so I've time-shifted it here by that 11 months. And you can see that the brown line on the right-hand side of the chart here is generally coming down. That's an indication of what's going on in the overall economy in 2014. It'll generally be easing downward. We're not getting any indications of a crash. We're not getting any indications of recession, just deceleration. But we're also going to see that deceleration in housing, which is something you need to be careful about. In terms of the ACA, and I'm just going back one or two slides, there's a national trend afoot that I want you to be aware of and I want you to consider. Whether it was an intended consequence or an unintended consequence of Obamacare, I do not know and I really don't care. But the trend is this: more and more employers are drawing a line in the sand when it comes to their health care costs, and they're saying, no more, I'm not paying any more. As these costs continue to go up, I expect you, the employee, to be paying more and more of this share. Because employers in the United States have by far and away paid the lion's share of the health insurance premiums and the health costs, therefore. And more we're seeing employers say, not anymore, I'm done. Just think about that from your own business, whether not doing that gives you a competitive advantage or whether doing that is necessary for you to protect your bottom line. Because health insurance costs are going to continue to go up. Health care costs are going to continue to go up. Whether the economy is slowing down or accelerating, that's going to be the case. All right, here we are with U.S. sawmills and wood production index. On the lower portion of the chart, we have the 3-month moving average in brown. We have the 12-month moving average, which takes away a lot of that noise in blue. And you see the trend is clearly positive. You should have had a good 2013. On the upper portion of the chart, we have the rates of change. They're scaled on the left. They vacillate around that zero line, and ROC stands for rate of change. Here you can see that we're going into a slowdown period if you look at that rate of change. 4.6 being the 312 is below the 1212 of 7.0. I told you that's a yellow flashing light. Deceleration is what's happening as we round the bend on 2013 and enter into 2014. And please notice that that 312 downward passing moving below the blue line happened before the winter. The deceleration process was in place before the polar vortex ever hit. This is a business cycle phenomenon, not a weather-driven phenomenon, is our interpretation. There is nothing in the leading indicators to suggest that we're going to see overt decline, certainly nothing like we saw over here. I don't think we're even going to see anything like this. We're just going to see a slowdown in the rate of rise in our businesses. And if you've been feeling too busy, it's a time to get caught up. It's a time to figure out what efficiencies you can get put through. It's a time to make sure that you're training your people. Because we have already a leading indicator to suggest to us that in 2015, we are going to be busier than we were in 14. And it's very likely that in 2016, we're going to be busier than we were in 15. So use 14 as just a breathing spell, if you would. But do not get concerned about it reversing direction. But at the same time, don't become manic about how great it's going to be because 2013 was so strong. Those types of years don't repeat back to back. For our Canadian, and because they are competitors of ours, I brought along Canada sawmills and wood preservation activity. And their year-over-year growth rate is 5.6% as opposed to 7.0% in the U.S. Here, however, the 312 is running above the 1212, not below it. Here, we haven't seen any degradation as yet in the slope of this 12-month moving average. It likely will come, but it's behind the curve in terms of a lagging phenomenon relative to the U.S. experience. Here's what's going on in inflation in the United States, as measured by the Consumer Price Index. The green line is the 112 rate of change. The blue line is the 12 over 12 rate of change. And what you're looking at is no inflation. Both rates of change are showing that we have a 1.2% consumer price index inflation rate, which is to say it's virtually non-existent. What that means for you and I is this. The Federal Reserve has all the latitude in the world that it cares to have when it comes to printing money and keeping interest rates on the deck. And that's not going to be bad for our businesses. It will eventually lead to some inflation, more inflation, which you and I are going to have to contend with. But in the near term, for 2014, that's not bad at all for business. There will be more inflation in the future. Our long-range forecast is that by the end of 2016, we'll probably see that blue line running at about 5.5% rate of inflation. That'll be above the Federal Reserve's comfort zone. That'll mean interest rates are likely going up at that time, but not much before that time. So we're in this extended sweet spot when it comes to interest rates. And while the CPI isn't showing much in the way of inflation, we sure are seeing it in terms of our hard, and it should be hardwood lumber. I'm sorry for that typo. Look at the price increases that have been going on through this industry, and the rates of change is showing that on an annual basis, we're up 15.0%. For the last 3 months, we're up 22.3%. 312 is still running above the 1212, which means it's a solid green light in terms of additional rise. After we get through this building season, the construction season that you were talking about, Judd, in 2014, because of the cyclical slowdown, this will undoubtedly experience an inflection. But going through our construction season, we should assume that these sort of trends are going to remain well in place because of the inventory issues that you also alluded to, Judd, quite rightly. It's only after the summer months that we'll likely see a cooling off period in these prices before we hit the next rising trend in the summer of 2015. This is what's going on in wages. I mentioned to you, I didn't throw the number on the chart, but I mentioned to you that the consumer price index is up 1.2% year over year. Wages are up 2.2%. So we've given our employees, or they have received, if you don't want to think of it as giving it to them, a real 1.0% increase in their wages above and beyond the cost of living. Now, please notice that once these trends start, they tend to continue in that direction for multiple years, particularly when there doesn't look like there's going to be any sort of recession to stop that rising trend, and we don't see a recession until out here. Now, also notice that it's a compounding phenomenon. It's 2.2% this year, but next year it'll be higher than that off of the 2.2%. What I'm describing to you folks is that you're going to be experiencing very real margin pressure, profitability pressure stemming from labor costs. And that one of your big management challenges for 2014, 15, 16, and 17 is to figure out how you're going to manage this pressure at a time when the consumer, at least for the end, the second half of 2014, isn't going to be in much of a mood for price increases. Make sure that you are able to differentiate and somehow explain prices away for some other reason, because if you don't, you're going to end up with margins that are diminishing. You'll end up in a period of profitless prosperity. Interest rates, as I said, are likely to stay low. This brown line, red or brown, is 30-year fixed rate mortgage. You can see it went up a little bit and then it's leveled off. That little bit of a rise was enough to give us a slump in mortgage originations. And that ties into the housing market slowing down in its rate of rise in 2014. Fortunately, it has stopped rising. This is the federal funds rate. That's the rate set, or at least influenced, by the Federal Reserve. Here's my daring forecast of the morning for you. Are you ready? I think zero, which is where we're at, zero. I think that's the floor. I bet you they don't go any lower than zero on interest rates. That's it. I know, it's quite a limb to climb out on, but I'm going there. Alan and I think there's going to be inflation in the future, and I've just given you one number. It's not hyperinflation. We do not see hyperinflation, but there is going to be inflation. There is going to be a time when the government is pushing interest rates up because of inflation. There's going to be a time when the marketplace is going to be pushing interest rates up because of the probability of inflation. If you understand that interest rates aren't likely to go below zero and that inflation in the future, albeit mild, still means higher interest rates, then you can appreciate that these are sweetheart interest rates that we can experience for about another year, another 18 months before they're gone. What that means is the only economic rational activity you can make is to take advantage of these low interest rates in 2014. And by take advantage of them, what I'm talking about is borrow as much money as you possibly can in 2014. And use that borrowed money to buy wealth-creating assets. Wealth-creating assets equals equipment for your businesses. Maybe buying a competitor. Maybe moving into a new market. It means buying real estate. It means buying equities. That's what you do with this borrowed money. The question arises, how much money should you borrow? If you're sleeping all the way through the night, you have not borrowed enough money. All right? You should be tossing and turning and wondering, what have I done now? Do it in 2014 while there's still time to capitalize on that leverage. If you wait until you're absolutely sure everything's going right and you wait until 2016, that's too close to the top. If you're within 7 years of retiring, do not follow this advice. You're too close to retiring to take on that much debt. But if you've got at least 7 more years ahead of you, then leverage up, folks. Take advantage of this opportunity. This is a chart that Alan doesn't like to show because it's not common anyways for most people to think about the bond market. I bring it along because the bond market happens to be a more prescient far-sighted leading indicator than the stock market. It is also much bigger. And what I want you to see is that the 312 rate of change, this blue line, is now above, barely, but it is above this gold-colored line, which is the 12-12 rate of change. In other words, I have one of those solid green lights that's now back here in the bond market. The bond market is the furthest out leading indicator we have in our arsenal. It's this one, then it's the ITR leading index, and then you get into all the others. So what I'm showing you by virtue of that little blue spot coming up here is that we have a statistically significant event developing that provides us with our first empirical data that says 2015 is going to be better than 2014 for everybody in this room. So we're taking it out of the realm of probable or theoretical, rather, not probable, but theoretical, and putting it into the realm of empirical. And that should give you confidence about 2015 and beyond. Consumers in great shape. You're looking at credit card delinquency rate, overall consumer loan delinquency rate in blue, credit cards in red, and comparing it to the 10-year averages. Savings are about twice as high as they were before 2008-2009. Our balance sheets are in great shape. Federal Reserve tells us household debt's the lowest in 29 years. Household wealth is the highest we've seen since 2008. Consumer is in great financial shape. So to make that actionable to you, let me ask you a question. How many of you are in sales? Show of hands. All right. For the life of me, I don't know why everybody doesn't put up their hand, because aren't we all supposed to be in sales in some manner, shape, and form? But for those of you that are directly related to sales, and put your hand up, what I've just described to you is this. The consumer has money. The consumer has a clean balance sheet. The consumer is saving more than they've ever saved before. They are acting in a decidedly un-American way. You are morally obliged to separate these people from their money. Turn them back into being real Americans rather than this sort of hybrid European type behavior. Can't tolerate that. Here's total retail sales deflated. And the rates of change are on the top, and you can see that 3.9% blue number, which means on the last 12 months we're up 3.9%, well above the 2.5 that we're looking for. You'll notice the 312 is running a little bit below that at 3.5, so we're getting some slowdown, although it's not statistically significant yet. On the lower portion of the chart, we have the actual data, and that brown line is the three-month moving total. And you can see it peaks every year, big peak every year. And it peaked this year. And then there's a big drop after that big peak, because after every Christmas, we return our Christmas presents, and that's what we're doing through February, or we're doing through February. Our analysis is that employment will be slowing in its rate of rise. Our analysis is that retail sales will be slowing in its rate of rise also. But you and I need to watch out for is how much is it going to slow down. I pointed out the recession of 2000-2001 to you right in through here. Notice retail sales never went negative. The rates of change, at least the 12-12, never went below that zero line. It's a lack of growth, not negative growth, that can get you into trouble. And that's what we need to be careful of, closely monitoring for 2014. The blue line is the S&P 500, talking about stocks for just a moment. You can see the decline that happened in January and the subsequent rise in February. January was interesting. When January fell like that, the newspapers were full of how that January is normally a harbinger of a bad year. Well, because I'm an economic nerd who likes numbers and has way too much time on his hands, I wanted to know exactly what that meant. So I went back to 1950. And when January is a bad month, a negative month compared to December, it means the year as a whole is going to be bad 68% of the time. Now, 68% of the time in economics is a fairly high probability. It's not great, but it's fairly high. But then I dove deeper into the numbers, and I noticed that in each of the last four times January was negative, the market wasn't negative for the year as a whole. In fact, it on average was up 16.2%. So if you weight the results by more recent history getting more weight, then that negative movement in January doesn't mean anything. Therefore, seeing it move up in February wasn't all that surprising. What concerns me, however, is this analysis. The green line on this slide is the bond market. Bond market leads the stock market through highs and lows. Just take 5 seconds to go from left to right on this chart. It begins in 1996. And you'll see that the timing relationship isn't particularly neat. There can be a long lead time between a peak in that blue green line and a subsequent peak in the blue line, or it can be fairly short. But there is, you give me a shift in direction for that green line, and I'll show you where there's a shift in direction for the blue line that eventually shows up. And that's what has me concerned. Remember, one of my initial slides had stock market worries. That blue green line is eventually going to show up in the S&P 500. The reason I am demonstrating this to you is because I want you to know that we know that it's potentially out there. And I also want you to know that it is not the type of market that you need to be running away from. Do not pull all your money out of the stock market. Protect your profits instead. If you're invested in ETFs or individual stocks, think about putting in trailing stop loss orders to protect yourself against the downdraft. If you have a significant equity position, I mean, good size, your financial planner should be able to use puts and calls to give you some collar around your investment so you still experience the upside without experiencing the downside. That's what my guy has shown me. Or you can always invest in an ETF that shorts the market so that when the market goes down, this ETF skyrockets and you have bought yourself some relatively cheap insurance. There are things that you can do to protect your profitability against a potential decline without getting out of the market. Second thing I'd like you to know, even if this market pulls back 20 to 25%, which would not surprise me, don't panic. There is very little correlation between the magnitude of decline in stock prices and the corresponding change in the overall economy. Now, if your end customer is high-end, really high-end homes, then you'll see some downside effect. But if you're mid-market, low-market, industrial market, you'll see very little impact from the stock market going down. You know, the guy who runs the Maserati dealership is not going to be in the mood to build a new, bigger house when the stock market is going down because we'll buy fewer Maseratis. We buy fewer Rolexes. So there's going to be a pause in those markets. The pause is likely to be short-lived, which is the third point. We think it won't last any longer than 8 months. It may last as brief as 3 to 6 months. And then it's over with and we're back up to rising. Why? Because corporate profitability in America is going to be back on the ascent. Why? Because most people know the bond market is not a good long-term investment right now. Why? Because the massive amount of liquidity sitting on the sidelines looking for a place to be invested is going to fuel this market back into a new bull trend. So expect a short, sharp bear to happen sometime in the not-too-distant future. If it does, don't panic. And if it does, use the bottom as a next buying opportunity to get back into this market for everything that you are worth. That's what this chart is telling us. Here's housing starts in the United States. Upper portion of the chart has our rates of change. Blue line is the 12-12, and you can see that's down to 17.1%. And the brown line, which is the 3-12, is below that at 15.4. So we have a flashing yellow light that says deceleration, deceleration. In January, if we isolate to the month of January, not the last 3 months, but the month of January, January came in just 0.7% ahead of 1 year ago. Notice, though, that this deceleration process, the rates of change coming down, was in place well before winter, well before the polar vortex hit most of the country. I think the weather exacerbated the weakness. Gave us a little extra oomph down and through here. But it didn't create the cycle itself. We were already moving towards slower growth before the very bad winter came upon us. I already gave you the forecast numbers for housing. Slowing rise in 14, better rise in 15, even stronger rise in 16, some more rise in 17 before we hit a recession in 2018. Now, when I said recession in 2018, if you flashed over to this trend here, you made a serious mistake, my friends. Because that wasn't a recession, that was a disaster. That was a catastrophe. That was an asset price bubble bursting, and there is no probability that we see anyways of an asset price bubble bursting in 2018. I said there's going to be a recession in housing. That's a recession. That's a recession. That's a recession. Eminently manageable. Particularly if you are venturing into new markets or new services, new products, doing something different come 2019 than you're doing today. Find people who are doing different applications and service their needs. That's the key. Companies that are less than 7 years old typically don't experience recessions unless it's a catastrophe like 2006 through 2009. So let me frame what I just said in a slightly different way. Come 2018, 2019, what part of your business will be less than 7 years old? It'll be that new. And the key is, when it's that new, you are invariably taking market share away from somebody else. That's the key to beating a business cycle, a normal business cycle downturn. You're taking share away from somebody else by moving into new markets. This is overall housing starts. This is existing home sales. January was very rough. You can see the 312 went to minus number, minus 2.7. But that shift in the rates of change was happening before we got into winter. Again, slower rate of growth. Going back to housing, because that chart that I just showed you confirms the deceleration. Normal recession in 2018, back into rise on the other side of that. Our forecast at ITR is that this general rising trend, while interrupted by recessions, will not end until around the year 2029, 2030. That home prices, which are clearly rising in most parts of the country, will continue to generally rise until around the year 2030. That we are embarking on what is going to be about a 16-year period of expansion in the housing industry. And our industrial economy is going to be growing through that time as well. That means you have lived through the very worst of times, and what you're about to experience comparatively is the very best of times for the next 16 years anyways. How many of you are 44 years old or younger? Can I see a show of hands if you're under 44? All right. What I just said, if you read between the lines, is that it sucks to be you. Because you'll still be in business more than 16 years from now. The rest of us will be retired. Maybe you'll retire early, and that's cool. I encourage you to do that. Again, sell the business to your kids. Let them take it down. Multi-unit housing starts. Faster rate of growth than we're seeing for single-unit starts, but the same rate of change signature. 312 running below the 1212, decelerating rise. I mentioned 100, maybe 120 additional million people in the United States. In our view, the majority of them will never own their own homes. That's going to be a signature trend reversal in the United States, which means that this market is going to be experiencing more fundamental growth than we've seen in the past. And that while we've completely recovered to the building levels we saw prior to the Great Crash, there's a lot more rise left to go in this market. Folks, buy real estate. Buy more real estate. And when you think you're done, buy even more real estate. If you talk to a realtor, it's always about location, 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 right? Well, I'm telling you that in economics, there's three locations that matter. In economics, the three locations are these: brownfield, not greenfield. When you look at the aging population in the United States, when you look at the immigration patterns of the United States, you want to be in urban areas, not suburban areas. Particularly given how much farmland has already escalated in price, you're going to make more money in brownfield than greenfield development. Two, I don't know why, but Most of us love views. We like views. So make sure that this property, this home, has a view. And third, for whatever reason, we're wired to want to live near water, be it a lake, a river, the ocean. We crave being near water. Of course, if you're going to buy oceanfront property, you have a conundrum, right? I mean, if you've seen Al Gore's movie, how close to the water do you really buy? Well, at ITR, we study real trends. And the real trend is the world's ocean levels are going up at the rate of 11 inches every 100 years. So you go ahead and buy your oceanfront property. Just make sure that it's 3 feet above high tide, and you got a good 300-year investment. Heck, you can put marble countertops into that 300-year investment. It won't be a waste of money. Don't be afraid of that oceanfront property, in other words. Or go for the trifecta and buy a single-family dwelling unit that you can lease out that's on the 43rd floor overlooking some lake or river or ocean. Because that's what people are going to crave the most in the future. Please, go out there and do it, and then rent it. If you're from the South is giving us the same rate of change signature. South is the single largest market for housing starts. And you can see that this slope isn't being repeated, it's decelerating. You can see that very clearly out of the rates of change. No downturn, just deceleration. If you're from the West, see how that brown line has surged above the blue line again? That's primarily because of Colorado. You know, you pass a pot law and all of a sudden very strange things start happening. Colorado is just exploded with activity. Generally speaking, the West is slowing down. It's not breaking down in its rate of rise also. The Midwest, very clear slowdown in activity, only partly brought on by the weather. And in the Northeast, very small numbers. And we're also there beginning to see the rate of change signature that says this slope isn't going to be maintained for 2014. So don't expect those numbers to be duplicated in your own budgets unless you have non-organic reasons to think you can grow that fast. Home improvement construction spending is different than housing starts because this 312 is running above the 1212. This is that solid green light. The extent that your customers or you are focused in this area, I think you're going to blow the doors off 2013. I expect in 2014 you're going to be very, very happy. It's in 2015 that we'll see some slowdown in the rate of growth here. And this is to depict the non-res side of things. This is commercial buildings construction. Got a long ways to go before we complete this recovery. But look at that rate of change signature up there. There's a solid green light flashing. Not flashing. How can a solid green light flash? That's a solid green light telling us that this is a marketplace poised for more and more growth. In fact, you want to know where we are? Where we are today is roughly akin to back here. We have all that yet to go ahead of us before the next recession. Are you ready for that kind of business, as typified by this sector? Let's talk about a few interesting challenges we have in front of us as an economy. This is U.S. public debt. Public debt means it's federal, state, and local government debt all rolled up into one, and it now equals 123.8% of GDP, which is higher than what Alan showed you last year. It's the highest level of debt we've seen as a percent of GDP since World War II, when we peaked out at about 130%. The question that naturally presents itself is this a clear and present danger to the United States of America? And the answer to that is it depends on how you define the timeline, which is really what economics is about, at least partially about. Is this a clear and present danger to the United States today? The answer is no, because today the U.S. government 10-year bond yield is running below 3%. And at an interest rate level of 3%, we can carry this debt load all day, every day, any day. The problem is interest rates don't stay down on the deck forever. All trends tend to revert to the mean, right? I mean, that's what economics is all about. You hit the mean, then you overswing it. Well, the mean on the 10-year government bond yield is 5%. According to the Congressional Budget Office, at 5% government bond yield, this means that the interest expense for the U.S. government will equal what they are spending on Social Security for us retirees out there in the future. The crowding out effect on terms of what they can spend elsewhere is amazing. And as I said, interest rates aren't going to stop at 5%. They're going to overswing that. I don't have a real long-term forecast for interest rates. Bloomberg does. They have a much better sense of humor than we do at ITR. Bloomberg says that by 2030, the 10-year government bond yield won't be at 3%, it won't be at 5%, it'll be at 16%. My friends, at 16%, the government can't afford to do anything but pay interest on the debt, given this chart behind me. I'm here to tell you, as your economist du jour, that what we have in the United States is a very clear spending problem, not a taxation problem. Raising taxes is not going to solve our issues, because raising taxes will slow down our rate of growth in the economy, which exacerbates this. It's a spending issue. And we've been told by the good folks in Washington that they had that sort of figured out because of sequestration. Let me show you what sequestration means. This is a chart that Bloomberg put together using Congressional Budget Office data. That top purple line is federal spending out through the year 2023. Without sequestration, the blue line is after sequestration. You can see what a game changer sequestration really is, how it's going to save us from ourselves. And that's not even going to last, because last week or the week before, Mr. Obama was out there saying he's had it with austerity. Austerity is over with. We're going back to spending more and more money in the future. I didn't even know we were in a period of austerity, for crying out loud. But he's already declared it over with. And as interest rates go up, that presents us with a very, very real challenging situation. And when it's a spending issue, you also have to worry about this, healthcare, because our government's trying to become more and more involved in the healthcare industry. And that may be good. More people being covered by insurance is probably a great humanitarian thing. What concerns me is this chart, which is unique to the United States. See that black line? That's how much money we spend on ourselves as we age. That inflection point is age 58 years old. It seems here in the United States, unlike our major trading partners, or some of our major trading partners, but it would be true of virtually all of them, as we age, there's no limit to how much money we will spend on keeping our bodies functioning. Now, I wish I could tell you that our life expectancy was better than it was in the UK or Germany or Spain or Sweden, but it isn't. I wish I could tell you that our infant mortality was better than it was in those countries, but it isn't. We just pay more for the same outcome. This is where people usually label me as dark or cold, and I don't mean to. I'm just an economist. The cost benefit of dumping that much money into a person 80 years old is highly questionable. Yet we do it every single day, which is why I asked you who is under the age of 44 and why I'm telling you that you're screwed, because there's too many people like me that are going to be sucking the life out of the healthcare system, and you're going to have to pay the taxes to put a new knee into my body or a new hip into my body or give me quintuple bypass surgery when I'm 93. Because that's what we do in this country. We don't run the cost-benefit analysis. We need to solve this problem if we're going to solve our national debt problem. It's that straightforward. Here's what I think you should do. If you're under 44, start visiting old people in the hospital. Stand very close to their beds and bow your head and pray, or meditate, whichever you want to do. And if you're doing this right, within about 60 seconds, an alarm is going to go off. I want you to jump back. And I want you to go, oh, is that your air hose? Might be. So sorry. We can turn this trend around. Problem is, we've raised an amazingly ethical and moral generation, and they're reluctant to do this. They won't save themselves, so society is going to have to come up with the answer. And a typical answer for the American society confronted with an amazing conundrum like this is war. We're going to end up going to war if we don't figure out another way to solve this. But in this war, we send only old people. It'll be a slow war. Very little gets done in the afternoon. or this trend line disappears. Or we have to incentivize the baby boomers not to take that health care. Maybe instead of saying, okay, Brian, I'll put $120,000 worth of hip into you, the government says, or I'll give you 10% of that value, $12,000, tax-free, but not to you, Brian. I'll give it to your kids or your grandkids or a charity of your choice. So they can take my disability and turn it into a retail sales event for the next generation. I promise you, if they were to make that offer, the next generation would encourage us to think more about oxycodone and morphine and a little bit less about new hips. And we could spur the economy on as we age and become more and more disabled. Or the government's going to do it for us, which is what happens in a lot of these other countries. I don't have Canada listed here, but if you're over 80 years old and you get cancer in Canada, guess what? They're going to take care of you. But they're not going to go through the heroic efforts that they would here in the United States. They're not going to expend that kind of money. And the outcome, as I said before, is not appreciably different. Somebody's got to figure this out. I mentioned the book that Al and I wrote. It's going to be coming out in July 8th, 2014. I encourage you to get it. It's about what you do to prepare for the rising trend. And although time is precious, let me just briefly say, for your kids or your grandkids to get ready for the Great Depression of 2030 to 2040, make sure that they learn three languages. Three languages. Most Americans know one. They should learn three. The first language that they should learn is proper English. The second language, in my opinion, is French. A lot of people expect me to say Mandarin or Spanish. Mandarin, you don't have to. They know how to speak English. They're just fooling you, all right? You don't have to go there. Spanish, unless you're planning on taking the public bus system during the Great Depression, don't even have to go there. French. Why French? For three very good reasons. One, French is the language of the intelligentsia. Two, Africa as a continent, because of its natural resources, is going to be the place to be over the next 25 to 50 years. And the second language, the common language throughout Africa, thanks to the French Foreign Legion, is French. And the third reason for learning French, if you know French, and your love life is magnifique, it's just amazing. Learn French. The third language that I think our kids should learn, after proper English, after French, the language is called math. If they can be bilingual and know math better than a typical American, then they'll have job skills, job potential that is global in nature, and we'll see them through a tough period just fine. For those of us that are older than 44 that plan on being retired by 2030, come 2030, what I'd like you to do is sell your real estate, sell your businesses, take that cash and invest it in government bonds. Preferably non-callable government bonds. Absolutely don't invest in U.S. government bonds. Invest in Canadian government bonds or Australian government bonds and or Swiss government bonds. But in 15 years, those are likely going to be the safest places for you to park your money during a whole lot of economic turmoil. You've got to be ready to switch gears rather quickly as we transition out of prosperity and into decline. I want to talk about some things that are going on that are very, very right. One of which Judd talked about, and here's another way of looking at it. We're down to 32.3% in terms of our dependence on foreigners for oil. 32.3%. You know, my age and older, I never thought we'd see that because we're so used to OPEC having driven our economy for so long and been in charge for so long. And I'm not talking as your environmentalist, but as your economist, thankfully fracking has made this possible. Along with becoming more energy efficient in terms of miles per gallon, in terms of LEED certified buildings, in terms of ENERGY STAR buildings, in terms of manufacturing processes, becoming much more energy efficient. All of which has meant that we are more and more in charge of our own destiny. In 2013, we surpassed Russia in terms of being the world's third largest energy producer. We surpassed Russia. According to the International Energy Administration, not the EIA, but the International Energy Administration, by sometime between the year 2020 and 2025, we will be producing more barrels of oil per day than will Saudi Arabia. Can you dig that? We'll be the world's number one oil producer. Do you understand all the economic ramifications of that? Instead of running perennial trade deficits where we're throwing dollars out into the rest of the world, we're running trade surpluses where the dollars are coming back to the United States. You want to know why the U.S. dollar is still the world reserve currency, why we don't see hyperinflation, why interest rates can stay so low? It's because of this. And that's happening without a coherent energy program from the federal government. It's happening because of economics. Mind you, about half of this is from Canada and Mexico. Remember the old people's army? I say we send them into Canada, take that oil. We can drop this number in half. Take about 2-3 weeks. Because we're only going to focus on Alberta. We're going to leave New Brunswick alone. Don't go running back. We only want Alberta, probably Saskatchewan. And we'll bring our own DEET for the Saskatchewan flies. We have a huge competitive advantage in the United States already, and it's only going to get better if we're smart because of this. One of those competitive advantages is that our electricity costs are so inexpensive. One of our competitive advantages is that we are the world's largest economy, and we're going to stay the world's largest economy. One of our competitive advantages is that we're a relatively stable government. One of our competitive advantages is that we're in the middle of the road when it comes to taxation. And what you see now is that manufacturing as a percent of GDP is on the rise. And unlike this last time where it was interrupted by the bubble of 2006 through 9 and real estate prices, this is going to be a sustainable rising trend because it makes all the economic sense in the world. This changes everything you thought you knew about where our economy was going and the need for infrastructure and the need for human capital. We baby boomers, we worked very hard at making sure that our kids went to a 4-year, 6-year, or 8-year school, or a 12-year school. Some of them never left school. And by doing so, what we've done is we've ensured that there aren't enough people who know how to work a hammer. There aren't enough people who know how to work a forklift, a CNC machine, drive a truck. One of the big changes we're going to see in the future is that wages for what historically were called blue-collar jobs are going to go up significantly because of supply and demand, and we're going to need more and more of those people as this trend continues. This is a fantastically great trend that's happening here, and it's happening in Mexico. That's it. Canada, I'm afraid, is being hollowed out in terms of its manufacturing. Manufacturing is leaving Canada for the United States or Mexico. Look at the luminary companies that have decided to manufacture in the United States instead of China. They're either closing down China or they're not going to China. They're coming here instead. Or in the case of Bayer, they're leaving Europe and they're coming here to the United States. Because our electricity costs are 1/3 of what they are in Europe. Because when you factor in environmental costs, regulatory costs, and electricity costs, we're so much cheaper than in Canada to do any manufacturing. And it runs from Wham-O toys to high-tech to Yamagiggles to Rolls-Royces to Toyotas, Toshibas, Airbus, Flextronics. Now, I didn't know Flextronics before I made this chart, but I am OCD, and I could not bring a chart along that had uneven columns. It was driving me crazy. So I had to find Flextronics, and I slipped them in here. They're a big electronics company. Contract manufacturing, et cetera. Huge businesses coming back to the United States. You realize the opportunity that means for us? You realize the energy dependence that, how much energy these folks are going to be drawing in terms of the industrial activity that Judd was talking about? This is a bonanza. This chart is so I can be a little bit controversial with you before I stop talking. This uses U.S. government data. It's right out of the Census Bureau itself. What we're doing here is we're looking at income divided into three categories, the lowest category, the middle income category, and the upper income category. And then in this column, we're looking at the percent of households in 1967 that fell into each category. So in 1967, 61.4% earned less than $50,000, 0.6% earned over $200,000, 39% were in that middle income. We fast forward to 2009, adjusting for inflation. So holding the value of $50,000 constant between 1967 and 2009. And notice that the people in the middle income bracket have gone from 39% of America to 45.9% of households. Using the government's own data, what I'm showing you folks is that middle income America isn't shrinking. Middle income America grew and is growing. Now the question is, why hasn't the government bothered to publish its data since 2009? But even using 2009 data, you can see that the American enterprise system is creating more and more people that live in the so-called middle class. And if you use Stanford University data that measures not so much income, because you can always lie about your income, and most people tend to underreport their income, not overreport their income, go figure. But if you look at what they own, their assets, and therefore how they live, from the beginning of Ronald Reagan's term and as president to the end of Bill Clinton's term as president, second term, middle-class America expanded by 50%. The American system works. So before we start looking at alternatives to what has been working, I suggest that we be very, very careful about how we are tinkering with a system that has worked. Should we get more and more people out of this bottom tier? Absolutely. But are we just going to take money from here and give it to here and say, there, now you're out of there? That's debatable. But I'm hoping you're going to take away from this presentation these 11 items. One, there are things going on that are very right within the U.S. economy for the longer term that we can overcome our debt with, at least through the intermediate term, and that the business cycle outlook for 14, 15, 16, and 17 looks good. And if you can bring that message home to your people, your families, and your communities, it'll be amazing. People just come to expect it, and it becomes that much stronger and firmly in place. As Alan likes to say, culture turns to behavior. I think culture turns to yogurt, but he says it turns to behavior. Number two, invest in customer market research. Tie number two with number four, really, to know what your real competitive advantages are. One way to decrease the price sensitivity of whatever it is that you sell is to find out what your customers really, really value. And then you market and advertise the heck out of that, minimizing price. It's one of the ways you're going to be able to combat margin squeeze going forward. But it'll cost you about $75,000 to do a double-blind market research study, get the results, and get that into a marketing campaign. But it'll be the most effective $75,000 you ever spent. Training programs, I've already talked about. Spend money on new products, spend money on marketing, spend money on advertising, because when you have a good, fair economic wind blowing over your left shoulder, all of that's efficacious. Spend money on technology. One of the best ways to beat future inflation is to be more and more technologically advanced. I started off asking you if you're ready to be even busier. I'd be adding sales staff and hiring top people to go into new markets, new territories. I steal the line right out of Star Trek. Are you ready to sell boldly where you have never sold before? Because fortune will favor you. Lock in costs because they are going up, my friends. Judiciously examine credit. That's a double-edged phenomenon. On one edge, what I'm talking about is, you know, lighten up a little bit in terms of your credit policies because the world is getting better. Most of your customers are in better financial shape than they were, and they're going to be okay for the next several years. The other side of that, though, has to do with your receivables from some individual customers. Here's the trend. Very large customers are looking at medium and small-sized businesses, and they're playing them. Used to be, you know, when interest rates were going down, corporate America was generating about 40% of its profit increase based on interest rates going down. Well, interest rates aren't going down, so they want to keep hold of their money for longer. So instead of paying you in 90 days, which is what they used to do, increasingly they're going to look you right in the eye and they're going to say, it's going to be 120 days to 180 days before I pay you. What are you going to do about it? And you've got to figure out as managers what you are going to do about it. You either build it into your pricing scheme, you certainly need to build it into your cash flow modeling, and you need to figure out how you are going to handle that trend, because it is real, and it is going to get worse. Number 11, work on what's next. What I mean by that is don't stop changing. Never rest. Until the day you retire, you can't afford to rest. One of my heroes is Deming. Remember the great management guru Deming? And he taught the following principle, and I quote, "It is not necessary to change. Survival is not mandatory." How are you changing to meet the changing needs of the future? Where are you going to be? I was told I have a hard ending at 11:15. It is 11:15, so I'm going to leave you with just two more statistics before I am quiet. One is a reminder. We are 21.9% of the world's economy. We're number one, and we're going to stay number one. The other one is another statistic that I haven't mentioned yet today, and that is Americans comprise 4.5% of humanity. 4.5% of us get to do business in the world's largest, strongest, freest economy. The next time our government makes a move you don't like or we screw up as a people, stop and remember 4.5, 21.9%. Remember the long-term trends. Take a deep breath and thank God Almighty you're an American, because tomorrow will be a better day. Because you and I are going to go to work tomorrow, and that's what we do. We make things better day after day after day. Thank you all very much. Take care of yourself. Thank you. 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 Thank you.